Welcome back. Our guest has arrived. She's doing double duty today, Professor Esposito's class, and now here. So we're working her hard. Thank you, Dahlia, for coming. Dahlia Mogahed has a consulting firm now that she'll tell us about, I'm sure. And she is, let me get my cell phone thing here. I have it right here. Here we are. So Dahlia Mogahed is a consultant now, specializing in coaching and consulting with Muslim societies in the Middle East, like individuals, companies, all of that, Dahlia? Okay, all kinds of people. You consult us today. Former executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, a nonpartisan research center. She was selected as an advisor by President Obama on the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. She's a board member and leader for many organizations, which include the World Economic Forum. On the global joint councils, like a lot of us are on, hers is a council on the Arab world. She's also a young global leader, YGL, for the World Economic Forum. I just read the Arabian Business Magazine recognized Dahlia in 2010 to 2013. It's one of the most influential Arab women, and the Royal Islamic Strategic Studies Center calls her one of the most 500 influential Muslims in the world. She co-authored a book, which you should take a look at, called Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, with John Esposito, who she was just with in the other class. Been a commentator for a PBS documentary on Inside Islam, which is based on the book with Professor Esposito, right? Now, that's all the really impressive stuff about Dahlia. I want to say I have found her to be one of the most insightful people I listen to, and I'm in sometimes rooms with her, and you're often in rooms with very people who think they're very insightful, and after a while you learn to listen to who's most insightful. So when Dahlia speaks in a group like that, I find everyone pays attention and starts taking notes. So recently we had a conversation about a lot of things, and I thought I'd like her to be able to say these things to you. So we're very, very lucky and fortunate to have her today, and it worked out well for her schedule. We did double duty, and we had a great lunch talking about all of you and what you're doing. So I want to really welcome warmly Dahlia to our class today. Let's welcome her.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here. What I'll talk to you about today is how things have changed in the United States since 9/11. And I'll talk to you about a lot of data and a lot of research on public opinion and American perceptions of Islam and Muslims. Before I do that, I really want to start by telling you a story, a personal story about me and my family and some difficult decisions we had to make. My husband and I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, with our one-year-old son, and on September 11th, 2001, we were going to be moving, driving our car from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to start graduate school. And so we were at a friend's house spending the night because our apartment was all packed up, and we just couldn't believe, completely shocked and then outraged by what we were seeing on CNN, on TV. In that shock and that horror, we decided that we would leave for our new home the next day. Now, as you might have noticed, I do wear a headscarf. And as such, I'm very visibly Muslim. My husband is of Egyptian descent. He also looks Middle Eastern, of course. And so we were afraid that driving across Middle America on that day would actually be dangerous. We had no idea what to expect. It was unprecedented, what had just happened. So we left the next day, and I was really nervous. I was nervous because I had a one-year-old. I was nervous because I looked so overtly Muslim and Middle Eastern right after this horrific attack. And we stopped for gas only once, only because we absolutely had to. And I literally hid in my car. I ducked down so that no one could see me, as my husband quickly got gas in the car and drove off as fast as possible. We got to Pittsburgh, and we were moving into our new home, which actually happened to be a duplex. Another family was sharing the same building. And the day after 9/11, and guess who moves in next door? So it was a very tense and confusing time. As we adjusted to a new city, a new home, and really what seemed like a new world. And so that was a Tuesday. And Friday was the day Muslims normally go to the mosque for their weekly congregational prayer. And nationwide, Muslim American leaders were warning people not to go to the mosque, not to congregate, to be aware of their surroundings, to not to go out alone. There were so many very serious warnings because many people were worried that the mosque that very first week after 9/11 would be a target for possible reprisal violence. So we had a decision to make. Would we go that first Friday or not? We had a one-year-old, and if we just stayed home, at least we'd be safe. Regardless of what would happen. Maybe everything would be fine, but we would be sure. If we didn't go, then we'd be fine. But we also thought about what that would mean. What does it mean when we allow fear to dictate our behavior? What does it mean when we allow people who were saying that we were suspects or that we were associated with this attack? What would it mean if we let that narrative dictate our actions? This was our country, and that attack was on our country. Would staying home actually be allowing these terrorists to win, to really truly create that division that they were trying to create with that attack? So we ultimately decided to go. We would put faith over fear. So we put our one-year-old in the car, didn't talk the whole way to the center that afternoon on Friday. There was tension, and we got there, our very first time in that new Islamic center for us. And it was strange because the parking lot was full. I remember it was hard to find parking, which was sort of surprised me. We went in and we didn't know what to expect. An angry mob, protests against us. And what we found was the opposite. Half of that congregation on that first Friday after 9/11 were people of other faiths who had come to show solidarity. And it was such an important and incredibly moving experience for me. Because all of those people, our neighbors and coworkers, also took a chance that day. Because had there been, had the mosque been a target, everyone would have been hurt. They also put their faith over their fear. That was an act of compassion and courage. And that experience on that first Friday made me realize and made me decide that I would dedicate my life to building bridges across cultures and religions. And it's also a testimony to the importance of interfaith dialogue, which a lot of people, it's become fashionable to sort of poo-poo. All of those people were a part of a community, an interfaith community that had been formed years and years before that day. And it's because of those relationships that they had come and made such an impression on all of us, made us feel like we were a part of that community, that city, and this country. So interfaith dialogue and relationship building has concrete and very important outcomes, even if we don't see them right away. It means that people have existing connections for when, an event like 9/11 occurs. They react very differently than had those connections not been there. I think interfaith dialogue, you know, creates a lush environment where a spark doesn't create a fire. In the absence of that, everything might seem okay, but it's very brittle. And the slightest spark could start a huge fire in that environment that hasn't been cultivated by dialogue. And really, this is my backdrop. And I tell this story all over the world. I especially tell it to Muslim audiences in the Middle East and other parts of the world to convey my experience as a Muslim American. Because it's very easy to get a very different impression when you're outside. These stories don't make it into the media. I'll get to my presentation very soon, but I went to Mecca in 2003. And I don't know if you remember, but with the Iraq War was starting, the invasion was in March of 2003, and President Bush actually was waiting for the end of the Hajj season to start the war. Okay, so it was coming, everyone knew it was coming, and it literally was just waiting for the end of Hajj. And that's the year I went to Hajj. And so I was there, with people from everywhere in the world, and I would have people, so you would sit next to a different woman every time you pray, and I would say, you know, not everyone, of course, most people didn't speak a language I knew. Most people aren't Arab and don't speak English. So it was very kind of limited how you would communicate, but I would always say, America. And it was like this horror would go across people's faces, and they would be so concerned about how Muslims were being treated in America. And these were people who were themselves from conflict, you know, ravaged places, that were more concerned and worried about how I was living in America than their own problems. And it was both touching and concerning, because it was such an exaggerated picture of how things were in this country, even in the last decade. And I do tell this story to balance out this view. And I also want it as the backdrop of the information that I want to share with you, which is on U.S. perceptions of Islam and Muslims from the perspective of empirical research over the past 11 years. How have things changed, and what impacts people's opinions, and what does that mean for the future? So I'm going to start with what I think are the most important points, and I'll go on after that to show you why these are my conclusions. First, What leaders say is incredibly important to how people view Muslims, and I would say any other group. People look to leaders to interpret events for them. The role of leadership cannot be overestimated. Two, public perception is linked more to media coverage than to extremist actions. It's a very bold statement, I think, maybe even controversial. But what the data suggests is that how people view Muslims and Islam is linked to domestic politics, not international conflicts. Third, awareness of Islamophobia or anti-Muslim sentiment in the US is significant today, more significant than it ever has been before. It is now recognized as a problem. And young people are the most likely to reject a link between Islam and violence. And for me, that's a huge reason for hope. So the first key conclusion, first key finding was how much leaders matter. I want to share with you some data that I think will surprise many of you. This is a bar graph that shows the percentage of people who have favorable and unfavorable opinions of Muslim Americans, and this is the general public in the United States. In March of 2001, 45% of Americans had favorable views of Muslim Americans, and about a quarter had unfavorable views. Now you notice that just a few months after 9/11, favorability of Muslim Americans actually went up, not down, where unfavorable views actually decreased. And that was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. What could possibly explain this? Well, I think it was actually George W. Bush. President Bush immediately distanced the attacks from Islam. Very responsibly, in those first few weeks, he made very strong statements where he said, Islam is a religion of peace, and that those who attacked us do not represent Islam. Now, he's standing here in the Washington Islamic Center. Now, it's interesting to note that President Obama has never visited an American mosque. But President Bush did shortly after 9/11, sending a strong signal to the nation that this was not an attack that should be blamed universally on all Muslims. And that was a very, very important act of leadership, because we averted what could have been very dangerous hate mongering in the first few weeks after 9/11, in a time when people were rightfully outraged, confused, and looking for answers. So leaders matter. Now, strangely enough, we would think that after an attack like that, people would initially be negative toward Islam and Muslims, associated Islam with violence, and then after a year, they may have had more time to think it through and gain a more nuanced understanding of what happened, and not want to simply blame an entire global community of 1.5 billion. But in fact, the exact opposite occurred, where around a year after 9/11, opinions actually got worse, not better. If you compare January 2002, just a few months after 9/11, and November of 2002, almost exactly a year later, people were more likely to have unfavorable opinions of Islam, more likely to say Islam doesn't teach respect for other faiths, and more likely to believe that Islam encourages violence. So what could explain this shift? Well, a number of things, including some prominent evangelical leaders' comments in 2002, including Billy Graham, who said Islam is a wicked, violent religion. Remember, leaders matter. Statements by the head of the Southern Baptist Church, who said that the prophet was a demon-possessed pedophile, a wide-eyed fanatic, a terrorist. And then, probably most damaging, was Reverend Franklin Graham. He actually gave the invocation at the Bush inauguration, who said, Islam, unlike Christianity, has among its basic teachings a deep intolerance for those who follow other faiths. This was also the run-up to the Iraq War. And that process involved a link between 9/11 and Iraq, a link between Muslims and Arabs generally and violence. So leaders matter. It's interesting to note that between 2002, November or January of 2002 and November 2002, there were no new attacks. There was nothing concrete that had happened to explain the spike in anti-Muslim sentiment, except for this steady rhetoric around the lead up to the Iraq War and these statements who went unchallenged by the president. The media matters. So this is a look at Americans' opinion of Islam as encouraging violence more than other religions, or not. And it spans the time frame between March 2002 and May of 2013. What you see here is very interesting, I think. First, between March 2002 and July 2003 was the Iraq War, and that's when we had the biggest spike. No new attacks. No attacks on U.S. soil during that time, but you had the biggest spike in the belief among Americans that Islam and violence were linked in the run-up to the Iraq War. And it seems to have stayed relatively stable since then. The Arab Spring didn't change it. Even the Boston bombing didn't change it, at least when you look at Americans as a whole. But when you break it down by political affiliation, a very interesting picture emerges. Now, we said that leaders matter. President Obama has a markedly more inclusive message about the nature of America. He was the first in an inaugural address to actually mention Muslims as a part of our country's patchwork heritage. His more inclusive narrative has been discussed, and people wonder if his personal biography, as well as his more inclusive message, actually has improved American perceptions of Muslims and Islam. And the answer is yes and no. So here's what the lines look like by political affiliation from 2002 to 2013. Democrats, like Republicans, had a spike in their belief that Islam and violence was linked in the run-up to the Iraq War. But then you'll notice that that perception among Democrats has been steadily decreasing. with the Obama presidential, the first presidential campaign, and then with his actual election, it actually decreased even further and has been steadily decreasing since. Now, among Republicans, it's a very different story. You should notice two things. First, that Republicans today are at least twice as likely as Democrats to say that Islam is associated with violence. Two, it has been steadily increasing ever since the the spike in 2007, perfectly coinciding with the beginning of the presidential election. It also spiked again with the second presidential election in 2011, 2010. It started in the late fall of 2010 with the Ground Zero Mosque, et cetera, and then kept going up among Republicans as the presidential campaign started to heat up. Now, what's even more interesting is that two domestic elections had more impact on Republicans' views of Islam and violence than did the Boston bombing. Their perception of Islam and violence actually didn't change at all before and after the bombing, but spiked 10 points coinciding with the two election cycles. Now, is anti-Muslim sentiment a problem? As someone who's been working in this field for some time, it was very hard to even get people to recognize that this even existed just 5 years ago. And now, it's, to my surprise, something that most people recognize as a real problem. So in May of 2013, so earlier this summer, the American public were asked how much discrimination is there against, and then named a number of people. And then were asked to say if it was a lot, some, only a little, not at all, or don't know. And 45% of the American public said Muslim Americans faced a lot of discrimination. Surprisingly, more so than even gays and lesbians, Hispanic Americans, African Americans, or women. The American public actually recognizes anti-Muslim sentiment as the biggest form of prejudice that America is dealing with right now, which is unprecedented. But again, when you break it down, it's very interesting because people who say that Muslim Americans face a lot of discrimination are less likely to believe Islam and violence are linked. And people who believe that Muslim Americans face no discrimination are more likely to actually express very negative views of Muslim Americans, which is kind of funny. But among Republicans, 69% say Islam is more violent than other religions or encourages violence more than other religions, and 29% believe that Muslims face a lot of discrimination. Among Democrats, it's almost switched, where the majority, 57%, believe Muslims face a lot of discrimination, and only 20% believe that Islam teaches more violence than other religions. So you really can see the huge difference. Nearly 70% of Republicans link Islam and violence, while only 1 in 5, 20% of Democrats, say the same. That same breakdown is seen when you look at age. So 18 to 29-year-olds, majority believe that discrimination is a problem among Muslims, and 31% minority believe that Islam encourages violence more than other religions, whereas people older than 65, it's almost exactly switched. So to go back to the key findings, leaders do matter. What leaders say, how they explain events to their followers, makes all the difference. Public perception of Muslims and Islam is linked much more to domestic politics and media than to the actions of extremist groups or international conflicts, or what happens during international conflicts. Islamophobia, or awareness of Islamophobia, has never been stronger in the United States, which means that when we as a country recognize a problem, we do start to work on it. And young people are the most likely to reject a link between Islam and violence. And that can give those who want to create a more inclusive America something to work for and something to build on. Thank you.
Okay, questions for Dahlia? Yes.
Hi, my name's Colleen. So I thought it was really interesting how you emphasized the role of leadership, and you also spoke about how President Bush's positive comments made a significant difference, but then how evangelical leaders' comments really contributed to kind of a lot of Islamophobia in the United States. So I'm kind of curious, in your research about leaders, is it, who do you think has the larger difference? Is it kind of local leaders, so maybe local politicians or congressmen, local church and religious leaders? Do those people have a more significant impact than maybe more national, like popular figures? Would you say, like, which leaders do you think have a stronger emphasis?
It's a great question, and I don't have any research that would definitively answer that. And it's very hard to get to really dig in and figure out who is influencing people more, because we as Americans believe we are very independent thinkers, so we don't actually acknowledge that we're being influenced by anything, even though of course we are, like anyone else. So what I think President Bush really did is he signaled to the country and to his own constituents that this was what we needed to be, that this was the message we needed to be behind. He signaled that it was not going to be okay to fan the flames of hatred in those first few weeks, that those first fragile few weeks after 9/11. And then he's basically stepped away, and when he did that, that message was changed, and he never commented. It was to his silence, and so people saw that as perhaps an acquiescence, or at least that he didn't have a problem with these other statements that were being made that were seen as inflammatory. He then, later in his presidency, did also make other other damaging statements. There's things like in the run-up to the Iraq War, the axis of evil speech. He later used terms like Islamofascism. But really, it was those first few moments where he made such an important difference when it really was needed. But then the rhetoric changed.
Yep, and what I'm struck with by that is how the rhetoric changed because of domestic politics, mm-hmm. more than new acts of extremism abroad. So a lot of us were surprised that he was so inclusive right after the attack. That wasn't the George Bush that we expected. But it was really very, and I love the word signal. He sent signals. And that's what leadership always does, send signals. It's all right to think this way, but not that way. But then the Iraq War became, all of a sudden you were listening more to Cheney or to McCain or to others who were kind of whipping us up for the Iraq War. and he was quiet. And so again, it was a domestic political situation more than new acts of terror made him more silent. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly what the data suggests.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Spencer. Here, I'll pass this to Spencer. Here we go.
Well, I also want to say on that point, though, recall that in 2003, a lot of religious right leaders pushed back pretty hard against Bush, with people like Richard Land saying, well, he's earned some wiggle room with the evangelicals, but he's the commander-in-chief, not the theologian-in-chief. And leaders who were influential at the time, like Ted Haggard, like Gary Bauer, repudiating the president and saying, he's wrong on this.
So my question is about the media. You brought up how public perception tends to be more based on how the media covers these sorts of issues. And we talked earlier today about how a lot of times the media focuses on the negative or more extreme or radical conflicts between faiths and across faiths instead of the more collaborative collaborative efforts. And I'm just thinking of, like, I'm pretty sure it was a week ago, Jon Stewart did an interview with Malala, the amazing 16-year-old girl who's fighting for peace, essentially, in the Middle East. And I kind of want to know, because that's the first and one of the only, like, positive media stories that I can think of, at least in the past couple of years, where somebody who's clearly Muslim, like, proud of her faith, being shown in, like, a positive light. What do you think the impact of that will be on U.S. perceptions of Muslims in America? And also, that's my question. Leave it at that.
Well, thank you for that. I think that it's ultimately going to be a positive impact. But I think we just need so much more. It feels like a drop in the bucket against, you know, an avalanche of other very negative messages. And it might be more in the field of culture than even in the field of policy or news media. I'm always marvel at the idea that, you know, some studies of young people in Muslim-majority societies show that 90% of them believe Americans are friendly, okay? Which is really interesting, because the vast majority of them have never met an American. But they have this idea about us that we're friendly. And yet, at the same moment, they see, and they very openly tell us, that they think our government is aggressive, easily provoked, you know, power hungry, a military, wants to go to war against everybody, but they have this strange way of connecting or disconnecting American people with that image, despite having never met an American. And when you really dig into it, the reason is because of our media. I mean, we've successfully humanized the American people for the world through our popular media. People feel like they've met and really like an American because they really like the show Friends, or they really like whatever, you know, program or movie that they've connected to on a human and emotional level. But that cultural exchange is just one way, right? There aren't any humanizing cultural, very few cultural expressions moving the other direction. I don't think we have anything even close to that. So Malala on Jon Stewart was like one little drop, and it's wonderful, but how do we bring that, just a humanized face of all these other societies, you know, to our shores as well?
I'm curious on that. I don't watch much evening television on the networks. So are there any Muslim characters on any of the shows that are on, that either positive, negative? Are there any Muslim characters that are on any of these shows? Does anyone know?
They tend to be, I think there might be one or two. I don't want to say none, because somebody will find, you know, one example, but very few. Mm-hmm. Where Muslims unfortunately tend to pop up in our TV dramas is in dramas like that are dealing with the war on terror, and they're not good guys. Or if they are, they're, you know, the token kind of good Muslim who's killing the other bad Muslim. I mean, there's always a story there that leaves, I mean, there are studies that show Muslim portrayals in Hollywood films and television, and they're very, very negative. So it's not only an absence, it's actually a very negative portrayal in most cases. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this isn't about sanitizing Muslims. It's just about portraying them as human like anyone else, with flaws and strengths just like anyone else. Just, you know, I don't think the characters and Friends are saints, but they're human beings, and people like them because they can relate to them. And I think that same kind of thing would work, you know, for any community.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple comedians, Muslim comedians, yeah, that just went on tour. You've heard about them.
Yeah, right.
That were doing just what you're describing, putting a human face to people. Right. It was. I saw a clip of it. I haven't seen the whole video.
It's Actors of Evil?
I'm not sure. But it was hilarious. Like, I was laughing the entire time.
I think they
time.
Called themselves, like, the Axis of Evil, going off of, like, what Bush said, to kind of poke fun of the whole, like,
It was a woman and a man, right? And then the man was Egyptian, and I forget where the woman was
from.
There was,
like, three of them, yeah. Okay. It was really funny.
So it was positive. It was a positive human face. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, using humor, so.
Okay.
It's powerful.
Very powerful. Yeah.
Okay. Kendall.
So my question revolves around kind of a branch off of Spencer's question. What do you think, have you seen any kind of new role that women are playing in this effort to bridge the two different cultures? Because at least in my own experience, I think that, you know, what they're calling is, I don't know if it's the third feminist movement or third wave or fourth wave or whatever wave we're on, but... with the work around the world for women's rights, it seems like that to me has become a kind of a meeting place for women around the world, and specifically between, you know, American women and women in the Middle East, and, you know, that's where Malala comes in, and that's where another young woman who actually was at the Clinton Global Initiative on stage with, you know, Sheryl Sandberg and Bono and President Clinton. And she, I think her name is, Kalita Brohi. And just kind of this, I don't know, another example, Sharmeen Obaid-Chinoy, who's a Pakistani Canadian filmmaker who just recently won an Academy Award for her work on a documentary or whatever, and about women's education around the world. And actually, I just wanted to mention another example that of it kind of starting to percolate into American culture. There's a new, this TV series is not new. I think it has been played in other countries, but it's called A Little Mosque. Mm-hmm. And it's being played on a new American network called Pivot, which is specifically branding itself as a smart and socially engaging network for young people, so like kind of an MTV of sorts, but with a kind of a very different edge to it. So I guess my question is really, are you seeing any kind of, like, are you seeing this connection as, you know, coming from women? Do you think that that is a place where things can start? I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I do think that women have a huge role to play, and I do think it is a meeting place. At the same time, it's very interesting. It's also where there's the most polarized emotion is around the issues of women. It's always very interesting to, when, especially in Europe, but more so in Europe, but even in the United States as well, when it comes to issues around women, there can be some of the most heated and passionate kind of like irreconcilable differences that people just hold on to. Whereas there's so much common ground, and that's usually where people focus, and that's what we should focus on, there will always be these places where I think, especially when it comes to women, some very, very strongly held views on another side. I mean, I've been invited to speak to kind of what I'll call establishment feminism groups in America, like NOW, National Organization of Women, and it was like a local chapter. But I have never felt more hostility ever in my life than that group. And it was, you know, it was a group of women at the time. I was younger than now, but they were about my mom's age. Very accomplished women, all white, middle class. And something about me really offended them. It was like a different way of being a feminist and that they did not want to deal with. And it wasn't everyone in the group, but it was the three leaders. It was like the president, vice president, the treasurer. They were so, I have never experienced like 2 hours of such bullet dodging. So, I mean, the issue of women is so explosive. I think there's so much potential there, but there's also a lot of unresolved sensitivity that we still have to deal with. And the other thing about when it comes to women is women can become a scapegoat for violence. And here's what I mean. For a very long time, you know, people in the developing world have felt, many of them have felt, that the liberation of women is used as a pretext for colonialization. The liberation of women is used as a pretext for military invasion. It, you know, certainly was in the rhetoric around Afghanistan as well as Iraq. So people have become incredibly defensive when it comes to Western advocates for Muslim women and their liberation. And that's why it well-intentioned Western advocates for gender justice always have to tread so carefully in this area, because not only is there misunderstanding on the Western side, but there's a lot of misunderstanding among, you know, Muslim societies, and a lot of a great sense of defensiveness, where, you know, if you ever pick up my book, I have a whole chapter on women and what women think and what women want, and then I give advice to people who want to advocate and want to work with Muslim women. What is the best way to do that? Because there's like a landmine. I mean, I didn't realize until I got into it. It's like, you think it's this easy topic, but it ended up being the most, the hardest in many ways because of this huge history. And so many things that people, I think, are assuming about each other rather than having that dialogue.
I'm not quite in the category of your survey group, but I'm wondering what you think the differences are and why the older generation has such a negative perception. Is it media-driven? You know, the younger population probably has access more to computers, website. They use it. They get a lot of different information than maybe 65 plus or are home watching the evening news. I don't know, but I'd be curious to find out if you've looked into that and what you've discovered.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think younger people tend to be, you know, the whole idea of Generation Y are much more comfortable with pluralism, much more accepting generally of people who are different from them. It's just how they've always, it's just how they've been brought up. It's a different world, and what they take for granted is totally different than what someone much older takes for granted in terms of the norm of the way things just should be. I think that's one thing. I think another, and I'm just sort of speculating here, but I think another factor is their interaction with different people. The chances that an older American has ever met a Muslim are probably a lot smaller than most college students who've definitely had Muslims in their classes. I mean, there's, you know, no way to avoid us in universities, right? So I think young people are just much more likely to have interacted on a human level with people from across the faith spectrum, and including Muslims, and are much more sensitive to that kind of discrimination, and aren't as quick to buy into the propaganda.
We talked about that in the last session again about friendship, relationship. My son is 10. Something came on TV recently and about Muslims, some like news show. Somebody made a comment, and he just jumped up and said, "That's not true. My friend Muhammad isn't like that at all." Wow. And his classmate is named Muhammad at a public school in D.C. So again, it's this whole relationship, friendship, conversation piece that really, and you know, again, back to the other. The other is somebody whom we don't know. By definition, the other is somebody we don't know. So we call them the other. It isn't Muhammad, it's the other. They're like this. And so Jack says, he's kind of saying, that's not the other, that's Muhammad, you know. Mm-hmm. So again, it's that whole, and the younger generation just has more relationship, very simply. Other questions, thoughts? Michelle, I wanted your reflection. You talked at the end about the difference between, I wanted to raise this with Dahlia as well, toleration and respect. That your pastor said, your pastor home said, toleration alone is not enough, but interfaith respect is needed. Could you say more about what you're saying and what he's saying? I'd like to Dahlia to respond to that.
So the point that my pastor was trying to make is that toleration is very passive, and while you can tolerate someone who's in the same room and not come into direct conflict simply because maybe you're not acting on your emotions or not really taking the time to get to know them or to understand the actual difference. In contrast, what he was saying is that by fostering respect between religions or even just between people in general, you force yourself to kind of step out of your comfort zone, step into their shoes, look at their perspective, and develop a sense of, I understand your beliefs, and while I may not agree with them, I understand where you're coming from, and through that you can actually foster and build a real relationship. So I think that was essentially the point he was getting at, and he extrapolated it to the point where if you just have toleration, you'll never, or at some point you'll reach a breaking point, whereas if you have respect, you have a bond, and that will be a lot more difficult to break and come into conflict.
Yeah, yeah. That's what, you know, the story about, we talked about Heartsong Church, and I think what was clear on that CNN segment was this Christian pastor, this Muslim imam, had respect for each other. And they had a relationship and there was respect. And that's what those Muslim men in Pakistan, I think, were so drawn to. I mean, being tolerated is never really enough. You'd rather be tolerated than not tolerated. But I mean, what they saw between these two faith leaders was a respect. And they could tell they had a respect. And that's what caused them to call Pastor Stone and say, you respected us, we respect you too, you know?
Yeah. Well, of course, I completely agree. And I think tolerance is a lower form that, yes, anyone would rather be tolerated than be treated with intolerance. But that we have to strive for higher than that as a society. And I do think that mutual respect is that higher order. And I'd even like to take it even maybe further to collaboration. You know, I think, you know, if we go, the hierarchy can, I sometimes think about it as the lowest thing is conflict avoidance. You know, let's just make sure no one's killing each other. Okay, that's our goal. To a higher, you know, higher than that would be coexistence, which I think maybe is tolerance. Coexist. We'll all coexist. I will exist here. You will exist there, and we will, at the same time, exist, but not together. not interacting. And I think the higher order that really creates a society and a world that is lush, that is supple, that is resilient, and avoids having these small sparks turn into huge wildfires is one where we are collaborating, or we are cooperating, that we're working together for a common goal. And I do think that that has to be, today especially, our ultimate goal, because the problems we face, whether it's global warming or global poverty, they don't distinguish, they don't discriminate based on color, creed, or national origin. They don't see boundaries. And to solve and to attack those problems, to overcome those obstacles, we also have to be equally able to cross boundaries.
That's a great that's a great summary of our 2 weeks' focus on race and religion. I told you, she always says the right thing at the right time. I wish we had you for longer, but thank you very much
for
joining us today. So thank you so much.